Hello there, and welcome to the Palm and Pine Podcast. The boys are coming to you from their hidden camp, set deep in the Florida woods on the banks of the mystic Suwannee River. So let's take a moment and hear from the boys of old Florida.
All right, folks, welcome to the Palm and Pine Podcast, and we're glad to be with y'all folks today. Glad to be back and working remote today, and I've got, as usual, Professor Barlow here with me. He's calling in remote on assignment. How are you doing, Professor Barlow?
Outstanding, a little hot. Supposed to hit 100 today, but we're going to live through it.
Okay, 100 degrees, that's nothing for a Florida boy. Just don't talk about the heat index.
Yeah.
Hey, Douglas, we got a great guest today. We're going to get in some stuff, and we're going to learn a lot. I know I'm going to learn a lot. But I have today here with me Mike Meyer. So it's a pleasure to welcome him to the Palm and Pine Podcast. And I'm actually today in southeast Kansas. A lot of folks don't know this about me. I'm a true blue Floridian, but the U.S. Army saw fit to send me to Fort Riley, Kansas, back in 1991. So I've been kind of like a prisoner of war in Kansas for the better part of 34 years. And so I'm here in southeast Kansas today, and I just happened to meet Mike a few weeks ago, and Mike is a photographer as well. And does a lot of just incredible photography work for our local students. And so he had done graduation. My daughter had graduated. So went to pick up the pictures from Mike. And when I called Mike, I said, hey, I'll come pick up the photographs. Mike told me, he's like, great, Steve. Come when you come, meet me out in my shop. He said, I'm tinkering out in the shop. And So I came and met him out in his shop, and we're going to get into today what he was tinkering on, because it really, really got my attention. Next thing you know, I was there for an hour and a half with Mike. But we're thrilled to have Mike here today. And
he was not working on an A-bomb out there, though.
Yeah, he's not the Unabomber.
No.
Yeah, he was not working on a bomb. He wasn't working on a kill dozer, you know, a bulldozer. And so, you know, as a Florida man, that's what I was expecting when I came in the shop. But much to my surprise and pleasure, Mike is what I would call a true stargazer. Okay. And his hobby is astronomy. And we're going to get into this today, because the things he was building there in his shop, and I've got some video, I'll throw some video up on YouTube of some of this stuff. But the telescopes, basically, that he was building, they're bigger than me, and that's saying something. And anyway, bigger in girth than me, which,
yeah,
again,
they're not continually getting bigger.
Right. I'm continuing to grow. Now, Mike might tell you he's building bigger and bigger.
Once you have one, it kind of stays the way it is, right?
Yeah. His are more static inside the girth of his telescopes. But I want to read a little bit of this. Mike has spent decades really exploring the cosmos, and he's earned some prestigious awards. He earned the Astronomical League's Master Observers Award, and his certificate number is 22, so he was the 22nd person on Earth to earn that. And he's earned a lot of other awards based on observations, and I'm going to ask him to talk about some of that today. But it's just truly phenomenal, and I was just grateful to meet Mike, grateful to have him here on the podcast today. So welcome, Mike.
Thank you. I appreciate you asking me to be here.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to start, Mike, just kind of to open up this thing today, and you shared with me that your first telescope, you're a kid.
Yeah.
And when we were kids, we would get that Sears and Roebuck catalog right before Christmas, you know, about November. And boy, you can remember, I think most of us our age can remember thumbing through that catalog and just seeing all the neat stuff. And I remember there was two pages that had maybe the moon in the background. It had those telescopes.
Yes.
So that's how you started, right? When you were how old? And tell us a little bit about that.
I was 9 years old when I ordered my first telescope through Sears and Roebuck Company. It was a 2-inch refractor. Had a 2-inch lens in the front of it, a couple of interchangeable lenses for different magnifications in it, a simple hollow empty tube as an alignment scope on the back of it. But I ordered it through Sears and Roebuck, and back then there was no such thing as FedEx or UPS. There was just local independent delivery companies, and my dad owned one. Wow. And we delivered that telescope in the box to the Sears and Roebuck Company and had my name on it. So I knew it was there, and I was helping my dad for the summer. And then I went back that evening and picked it up from Sears and Roebuck.
So in a small town like Humboldt, Kansas, you knew when your telescope arrived right away, huh?
Yes, at least when my father was the delivery man, it had my name on the outside of the package.
So you started 9 years old. Okay, and so tell me a little bit about that. So you just in the backyard with this thing and started learning?
Just in the backyard with it. The Apollo program, the astronauts to the moon, was in full force at that time. And the space race and everything going on is why I got interested in astronomy. And you know, I distinctly remember the first time I looked at the moon and looked at Jupiter, the rings around Saturn with that telescope. Even though it was a very small and basic telescope, it was a good doorway or an opening into what a telescope would show me. And the features on the moon change every night as the terminator or the shadow line goes across the moon. Mm-hmm. So it looks different every night. And Jupiter will change every night as well. There are four large moons that orbit Jupiter. And even with a small 2-inch telescope like that, you can see those moons. And they're in different locations at different times. So they change from night to night. And I remember going out and make just little sketches and drawings about where the moons were. Wow. At what time and what night?
So you were already taking notes, learning all this, and I guess started to acquire some knowledge on where to look every night and where different constellations would be and map, kind of getting your orientation at an early age.
Yeah, and this was long before the internet.
Right.
So I often visited the Iola Public Library.
Okay.
I checked out any books on astronomy that I could, you know, learn the constellations.
Right.
And then I learned about a man named Charles Messier, and he was the first man to catalog what he called the deep sky objects, the star clusters, the nebulas, the galaxies. And he was a comet seeker. He worked for royalty back then, and astronomers were employed by the royal government. And back then, the mythology of it was that if a comet was seen in the nighttime sky, it was a harbinger of doom. So he would catalog these things that looked like comets as he was seeking comets. Comets move against the background stars from night to night, and sometimes by hour, you can see the movement. Huh. Well, he would find these objects that look like comets. He would catalog, chart them as to where they were at. Then he would come back two or three nights later. And if the object had not moved, it told him it was not a comet, and he really wasn't interested in researching what it was. But he started giving them numbers, you know, Messier 1, Messier 2, so he could keep track of these objects, and if he come across them again, he would ignore them in his search for comets.
Oh, okay. So he was numbering the things that were not comets.
That were not comets, yes.
Okay. Wow.
And him and then some other astronomers were doing the same thing, and he would put his number on some of their observations as well. He ended up with 110 objects.
Wow.
And they're referred to now as the Messier 100. And when people get larger telescopes and get into observing deep sky objects like this, these are the best and the brightest because they were the first ones that were found.
Wow.
So those are the ones that usually amateur astronomers go after when they start observing and recording and cataloging their observations is the Messier objects.
So that's where you start with those 100.
Yes.
Yeah, and when did you say he was finding these, or what time period?
It was around the mid-1600s, if I remember right.
Wow. So he had equipment enough then to kind of do that?
Yes. Wow. Most of the equipment back then was just 2, 3, maybe 4-inch refractors.
Okay.
They didn't have the technology to make larger lenses because the light has to pass through the lens, so you need a very quality lens with no impurities or bubbles or anything on the inside of it to
and
distort
so
the image.
The larger, the more difficult that would be to pull off.
Yes.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. Wow. So you started working on that 100. Well, how old were you when you'd found all those, you think, or when did that?
I would have started that around 1986 or 1987, so I would have been 26, 27 years old when I started recording the Messier objects.
Wow.
And it took me, I think, a little over a year to catalog all of them.
To get those. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, that leads into my second question, because I wanted to jump right into this, because you've earned really an impressive list of, I guess, these observation awards.
Yes.
And
yes.
Messier, is that, am I saying it
yes.
right?
Yes.
Okay. Being one of them. Could you maybe share maybe a list of those awards and their relevance, like which ones were like meant the most to you as well? Because I know there's numerous of them.
There are numerous ones. The Messier objects, there was 110 of them.
Right.
And the next one that people usually step into is what they call the Herschel catalog. And they were observations made by John Herschel.
Huh.
And he used, back then, they were using polished mirrors instead of lenses.
Okay.
Because the polished mirrors, they could make them larger. They didn't have to be a high quality of glass because the light didn't pass through the glass like a lens.
Like a clear lens. Okay.
So they put a reflective or a polished coating on them, and the surface of the mirror had to be as smooth as they could make it, but the quality of the, you know, the glass didn't have to be.
Okay.
So he was getting into making, using larger mirrors, so he was seeing fainter objects.
Wow.
And the Herschel, the first Herschel, there's 400 different objects that he located and cataloged.
Wow, okay.
And it's just a search to try to go out and find them.
Those 400.
Those 400. And then you have to write down a description of what they look like.
Okay.
What day you found them, time of night, general observing conditions, and then just a, you know, what you think the object looked like.
Okay.
And then I did that one, and then there are some that got into specialized lists, like there's the planetary nebula list, which planetary nebulas are stars that are in the final stages of their life cycle. They've burned up a lot of their hydrogen and helium, and they're losing their mass. Well, when they lose their mass, they lose their gravity, and they actually shrink enough that the outer layer of that star actually lifts off of the star and then is blown or expanded out in space by the solar wind. And some of these objects are very small, and some of them are large and faint. And they don't look like pinpoint stars, but you can usually see some detail, and some of them you can see some color in.
Hmm.
And there was a Astronomical League catalog of those that if you recorded all of them, observed all of them, you got a pin in or certificate for that.
Now, how many of those would there be?
I think there was around 75 or 80 of those.
Wow.
That... you know,
so
you
this
had to record.
Isn't an instant process of a star dying. So
it happens.
Over.
I think it usually happens over about 5,000 years.
Wow.
So it's a continuing process, and it, you know, they took photographs of these earlier when they first started doing photography, and then the current photography, they can see, you know, some changes.
Wow.
In the objects themselves,
it's evolving and dying. Wow.
And then one of the other catalogs I did was globular star clusters. And these are some of the oldest stars in our galaxy, in the Milky Way galaxy.
Okay.
The largest star cluster that we've seen from the northern hemisphere is Messier number 13, the Great Globular Cluster in Hercules.
Okay.
And they estimate anywhere from 100,000 to a million stars in this ball of stars.
Wow.
And through a large telescope, that's what it looks like. It just looks like a great big ball of stars.
Wow.
And I think there was another 70 or 80, you know, of these globular star clusters that you had to record and catalog, pin in their certificate.
Right.
Some of them were comets. There's a silver award for 25 comets, And then there's a Golden Award, I think it's 50 comets. And I have earned the silver, and I'm still working towards the Golden Award, but I have to catch them as they come around.
Wow.
And some of those are just a written observation, or you can do photography and turn in a photograph of it that way.
Wow.
So these, you know, we don't even have time to go through all the observations and awards you've done.
Yes.
But suffice it to say, there's been a lot of them.
Yeah.
Even given that, starting at 9 years old, and we're not spring chickens right now,
right,
you still have more to work towards.
Yes, yes.
So it's a hobby that I like in that you can never master it. You're not going to find everything.
Right. And there, some of the awards you can earn, you simply go out with a chair and sit at night and you draw the constellations. It's the Constellation Finder Award.
Okay.
But it teaches you where the constellations are at, the boundaries, what the different stars' names, locations are, and things like that.
Right.
So some of these awards you can do with nothing more than your eyes.
Yeah.
And some of them, there's the Binocular Deep Sky Award, and then there's the Messier Deep Sky Binocular Award.
Okay.
So some of them are just geared towards binoculars. Some of them are geared towards people that use smaller telescopes. And some of them are geared towards people who live in urban areas that don't have the nighttime. They have the light pollution, what you can see from urban areas with the light pollution.
So they kind of have a handicap.
They do.
So anybody, really what you're saying is anybody could get into this with little to no equipment and no matter where you're at.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's just, however, there's a thing in amateur astronomy, we'll call it aperture fever. You get a telescope, and then you want a bigger telescope, a larger aperture, a bigger telescope.
Oh, yeah.
So I started off with a 2-inch refractor, and then I went to a 10-inch reflector, a 16-inch reflector, and my largest one now is a 20-inch reflector.
Wow, that's incredible.
But I've had the 20-inch reflector for about 27 years.
Once you catch the fever, like any hobby or pastime, you're going to naturally expand.
Yes.
Well, that's awesome. And that brings me to, I'm going to ask one more question. I'm going to turn it over to Professor Barlow. But I want to go back to when I met you at your shop. Mm-hmm. And so just... I'll throw some video. I took some video that day.
Okay.
And I'd like to throw some of that up on YouTube while we're talking. And maybe just describe, you had, I think, three maybe in your shop that day. One or two you were working on and an older one.
Tell us
a little bit about, because there's some unique properties, I think, with what the type you're building.
Yes. The largest one that I had, and I currently own four telescopes with the StarMaster brand name on them. And they were made by Rick Singmaster, who lived around Fort Scott or Arcadia, Kansas.
Okay.
And he started off as an amateur astronomer. He bought a telescope that wasn't a real high-quality telescope, but he was an engineer. And he felt like he could build a better telescope than the one that he bought. And he did. He built one of his own, and he put quality optics in it. And I've looked through that telescope, and it's phenomenal, the quality of the image that you're seeing, especially on the planets and the moon.
Wow.
And he ended up quitting his job with the state of Kansas and built telescopes for about 25 years.
So he did it he started doing it for a living.
He did it for a living, yes. Wow. And then he passed away about 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Then I retired 3 years ago, and I got to wondering whether or not I could take up building telescopes as a hobby. And I copied his design a lot because, to me, he was the best telescope maker.
Sure.
So I started off, I built a 10-inch F5 Dobsonian reflector telescope, and I thought it turned out pretty good. And then I built a 16-inch F4.5 Dobsonian truss tube reflector. And then I sold it, and then I had the opportunity to buy a telescope that was probably about 40 years old. And the story that I got from the kid I bought it from was that it was in an observatory that was privately owned by an astronomer professor.
Hmm.
And that's all that the guy could tell me about it. And there were no markings or anything on the mirror designating who built it, focal lengths or anything, and it was in a solid tube that was 8 foot long and weighed over 100 pounds, just the tube. And then the Dobsonian base on it was not made very well. The azimuth bearing was too small. The weight of the telescope pushed the surfaces together and it wouldn't spin. And I ended up buying it from him. And I took everything out of it. The only thing I kept was the primary mirror and the primary holder, secondary mirror and the secondary mirror holder. And I converted it to a truss tube telescope that could be taken apart in sections and easily handled.
Okay.
And it turned out it was a 14 and a half inch F6 wow. reflector, which is kind of an unusual focal ratio. It's kind of long, but it gives excellent images.
Wow.
And I had that one sitting off to the side. Then when you came and visited me, I was working on a 14 inch F4.5 Dobsonian reflector.
Okay.
And I have finished it now, and I'm going to start advertising it.
Okay.
I build maybe three or four a year, but I don't advertise or anything like that. I just build them as a hobby and then try to sell them locally, or I put them on a national buyers or advertising page to let people know that I have it available.
So three or four a year, so kind of in your spare time and a couple months for each one or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
Just in my spare time and, you know, as I want to do it.
And I'll show some images, and of course, podcast listeners, you know, these telescopes, they're 4, 5, 6 foot tall, you know, from 16 to 24 inches, kind of the whole case. But the thing that's interesting too is yours are collapsible. They fold down. They fit in the back of a small car real easily, which I thought was just crazy clever to be able to do that with that big of a telescope, that you could basically put it down in almost like a shoebox and put it in the back of your car.
Yeah, so everything comes apart and then fits together. It'll all stack together.
Right, just to kind of nest together. Very clever, very clever.
And I give all the credit to that to Rick Singmaster.
Okay,
In Fort Scott, yeah.
Wow, that is
awesome. He really had a reputation for being a great telescope builder.
Very, very, very creative.
Yeah, I'm 6'3", and when I look through my 20 inch, I have to go two steps up on a 6 foot step ladder.
Wow.
To be able to get high enough to look through the eyepiece when it's up around the zenith.
But you can fit it in a small car.
That one needs a truck.
That one's
a little bit bigger.
Okay.
Yeah, the 14 inch will go in a car, but the 20 inch it needs a truck.
Okay. Well, we're going to showcase one of the model that you have for sale.
Okay.
And I don't know if you're comfortable with putting a price on that, or you auction, or what do you do for that?
Right now, I've got it listed locally for about $4,200.
Okay.
It's a 14-inch F4.5 with Hubble Optics sandwich mirror.
Okay.
And a Hubble Optics secondary, Dobsonian, and I have the Nexus Pro digital setting circles on it.
Okay.
All hand built, 3/4 inch red oak.
Can it like determine where it's at when you put it in outside?
It will, with the digital setting circles, you can do a 2-star alignment on it.
Okay.
Point it at one star and tell it what star that is. Point it to another star and tell it what star that is. From there, it has like 12,000 objects in its memory, and it will show you where these objects are at.
Wow.
You just tell it what you want to look at, and it gives you two different numbers, and you push it to when those numbers zero out, and what you're looking for is in the eyepiece of the telescope.
Awesome. Hey, Professor Barlow, I'm gonna let you jump in here. You're a lot smarter. You're a lot smarter than me. You got some questions?
Yeah, I do. I'm gonna get right to the heart of it, Mike. Do you use a Barlow lens?
Yes, I do. I have at least 2 or 3 different Barlows. I have a 2-inch, 2-power, an 1.25-inch, 3-power, an inch and a quarter, 2-power. I credit you guys for that design and making that.
Well, it was one of our ancestors. Well, now I know you're bona fide for sure. So let me ask you, these objective mirrors you use, I assume they're fairly complicated. It's not just like a concave mirror that you could polish or grind on your own. Is that correct? Tell us about them. You have to order them?
Well, there is a process where people make their own mirrors. And that used to be very common in the 50s and 60s. You could actually order kits that had a blank mirror and then the grinding mirror. And it came with all the chemicals, the powders, and the pitch lap and everything to check it. A lot of people liked doing that, but it's time consuming. But you get a better quality of mirror that way if you grind it yourself. And I suspect that's why the 14 and a half inch mirror that I have from the telescope that's about 40 years old is such a phenomenal performer.
So somebody
is because somebody ground it, and possibly the professor that was using it. If someone's going to grind their own mirror, they're going to take the time and make the effort to get it as accurate as they can. Where mass market mirrors, you know, back in the 50s and the 60s, you didn't always get that. It was just, they were pumping them out as quick as they can.
Right.
But now with modern technology, I've been told that they can laser cut a mirror and have it within a quarter of a wave and have it being able to be finished, you know, without really any grinding or texting. You know, they will test it, and some of them, they improve them up to a tenth of a wave. The smaller the number, the better the optics are, because you're measuring the error in the mirror.
Okay. But, and so with modern technology and modern applications, and they can do them even better.
Yes, and it takes away a person's having to grind their own mirror.
Okay. But not long ago, you'd have been better off to grind your
own.
Wow.
Yes. Wow. And it was pretty common that most astronomy clubs had mirror grinding courses in them. But some of the mass market mirror makers now, they advertise them as 10th wave or better, simply because the technology is so much better now that people don't have to grind them.
Now, all these years you've observed, I assume the moon a lot and other things that are kind of easy to look at. Have you ever seen something that you couldn't quite explain?
Never. I never really have. There was one night that I was out here in Humboldt, which is a small town, about 1,800 people. And it was a clear night, and I thought I saw what looked like a string of lights going across the sky. But this string, it kind of varied in length and, you know, it just shifted and shaped around, but it was just like a string of lights going across the sky, and it puzzled me. I didn't know what it was. And then it was a few months later, I saw it again, and it was another clear night, only this time they were flying lower, and I could hear them honking. They were Canada geese. And since then, I've been out quite a few times. It seems like when it's clear, the city lights reflect off of their bellies. And I was telling that story to a guy that worked at the local cement manufacturing company, which is a very noisy place, and you have to have earplugs in. And he looked up one time and saw, you know, a string of lights or a wave of light go across the sky. And he was asking me, well, what is it? And I said, well, I've seen that, and it's geese. They're Canadian geese, and you can see them. Wow. Just like you see them in the daytime, you know, the formation fluctuates and moves around.
Yeah.
It took me a few times seeing that to understand what it was. The first time, I think they were so high, I really didn't see the individual geese in it. But, you know, now that I know what it is, sometimes at night I can hear them honking. And before they get over the city, you know, I know what direction to look, and then I can see them, and they, you know, they start glowing. I think the oils on their bellies.
It was a string of Starlink satellites.
I've seen them before. The first time I saw that, I was down in a very small town in the Boot Hill of New Mexico called Rodeo, New Mexico. And I was at a place called Rusty's RV. And Rusty's RV is geared towards amateur astronomers like me. They keep the lights low. They keep the transient RV people off to one side. And they actually have pads that are poured and outlets. And they cater to people that go down and do the photography, the astrophotography, and then the astronomy. And I saw a string of starlights going over, or Starlink satellites going over. Mm-hmm. And I was puzzled at first. This is when they were first launching them. And then I realized what they were. And yeah, they're kind of fun to watch, but at the same time, these satellites are becoming such a nuisance to astrophotographers.
Did it look similar to the geese?
They did, except the Starlink, of course, they were more in a uniform formation and traveling at the same speed and, you know, same separation apart.
Right.
You could tell that it was man-made.
A little more uniform.
Oh, wow.
All right. Well, hey, you got anything else, Douglas? And I can close us up.
That's all I had, I think.
Okay. Great. Well, I tell you, we have one question, Mike.
Okay.
We ask this of all of our guests at the conclusion of an episode. And There's no right or wrong answer.
Okay.
It's just an answer. Mm-hmm. But my brother and I, we've been doing this podcast, and the best part about it has been meeting folks like you that have dedicated a lifetime to some type of pursuit or passion. So we get to hear all about it and learn a little bit ourselves about it, and mm-hmm. we appreciate that. And the final question is, in all your work, not just astronomy, but your life, if you had one principle or one foundational philosophy or idea or theme that has helped you throughout your whole life that you could pass on to a young person, or if even you could go back in time and tell that Mike that was 9 years old, hey, yeah. if you stick to this rule or this foundational principle, it's always going to come out for you. What would that be?
It would probably have to be morality.
Morality.
Just living, you know, a good, clean life, respecting others,
yep.
and just, you know, it's kind of an honor code. I was in the military for 6 mm-hmm. years.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Fort Riley. That's right. where I was stationed at. I was at Fort Riley for 2.5 that years.
Yeah.
Just the moral.
Yeah.
Moral code.
Just doing unto others as you'd have done.
Yes.
Kind of the golden rule.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, something
That's
like
awesome.
That.
That's great. Well, Mike, we appreciate having you. Appreciate you taking the time to come discuss this with us. We're going to throw some pictures up. And I know now you're getting into photography of astronomy as well.
Yes.
You do local worldly photography,
yes.
but you also do astronomy, and maybe if you give us one of those pictures, we could throw it up on the YouTube as well.
Yep,
and,
I can do that.
And what's the best way for people to find you and look at your work? Would it be Facebook?
Facebook,
email?
Yeah, okay. Facebook. I post a lot of my local photography of, you know, high school athletics,
right,
and then a lot of my astrophotography.
Okay.
And it's just Meyer Photography is
okay.
what it's listed as, or Mike Meyer.
Okay.
And it's just M-Y-E-R, Southeast
right.
Kansas.
Yeah, no S on the end, just
no
Mike
S on
Meyer.
The end. Mm-hmm.
And I'll throw those links in the description of the podcast, and I'll
okay.
put them there on the YouTube so folks can come check that out.
Okay.
And we hope to get you down to Florida. We have actually an observational area in our county because it's so dark.
Okay.
We're in a very rural area.
Yeah.
So we'll get you down there and get you in the field. We'd love that someday.
Yeah. Send me the address and I'm there.
All right. There you go. All right. Hey, thanks, folks, for tuning in today. And we've enjoyed this podcast, enjoyed having you. And we'll catch you next time, and keep it Florida. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of the Palm and Pine Podcast. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only, and should not be considered professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host or any guest are our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of any affiliates. Our opinions are just that, opinions, and are not legal or medical advice. But in our opinion, avoid lawyers and big pharma at all cost. Copyright 2025. Palm and Pine Podcast. All rights reserved. Please subscribe and share. Okay, until next time, keep it Florida, and we'll see you soon.